We ended last time our talk on the subject of the lower triple Purusha. We considered the three lower worlds with the three poises of the spirit presiding over them. We concluded that as long as we are in this triple formula, we continue to be under the shadow of ignorance. One has to exceed this lower triple formula and enter into the transcendence. This is very much what the ancients call in the Veda, breaking beyond the firmaments of heaven and earth, going beyond one's father and mother. For in the Veda, the heaven standing for the higher regions of the mind is spoken of as the father, and the material, the physical, is lauded as the mother. When the Veda speaks of breaking beyond the firmaments of heaven and earth, it means exceeding the lower triple existence and getting an entry into the higher triplicity of existence. It is extremely difficult for the human mind to get a stable entry into this region beyond its highest summits. Even the lower levels of this higher existence, of which we are to speak later, it is a feat for the mind if it can get a lodging there. In the system of which we are speaking, the whole universe, the whole of manifestation, is divided into two halves, the upper half and the lower half. The lower half consisting of the worlds of matter, life and mind, and the upper half consisting essentially of the worlds of sheer existence, consciousness force and bliss, with the world of light, the world of truth light, as the link between the two. There in the higher hemisphere, the Parardha as it is called, there is an illimitable manifestation of the glories of existence, the radiances of consciousness and force, the vast seas of bliss. Here in the lower existence where we live normally, the spirit is veiled. The glories of existence, the brilliances of consciousness, the floods of bliss are veiled, put in the background, and in the conditions of limitation, division and ignorance in which they are held, they are expressed many times in almost the contrary and even perverse forms, like pain, suffering, limitation. It is essential for those who seek to cross into the freedom of the spirit to extend their being step by step in these higher realms of consciousness. And it is possible because these worlds that constitute the different spheres of existence are not independent, separate entities, but form, luckily for us, a gradation of universes, a gradation of worlds on a series of planes. As we observed in one of our talks, a plane is an organization based on a particular principle of being. That on that plane, there can be any number of worlds, each stressing certain aspect of that principle. So always a plane is a larger term than the world. Now, Sri Aurobindo points out that on each plane, the spirit or the manifesting soul takes a particular poise as regards its relation with nature. The soul and nature, the inseparable biune truths, they take poise in different principles of existence. To start from our end, when the spirit or the being or the soul takes its poise in the principle of matter, physical matter, we have what is called the material world. The material world is another name for a system of relations that develops between soul and nature when they are based on the principle of matter. Here, the very principle of matter is one of inertia, fragmentation, in conscience. Accordingly, the relations between the soul and its nature are characterized by the clouding of inertia, ignorance and division. In whichever direction you look at it, these characteristics of physical matter are inevitable in the relations between soul and nature based upon the physical principle. In the universe, it is the spirit that takes the material form. In the individual, it becomes what is called the materialized soul. The soul that is encased in matter, that allows itself to be governed by the principle of matter. This materialized soul, what is called in the Upanishads the Annamaya Purusha, has its own relations with the world. It dominates all the principles that are woven in the individual system. The life force has to subserve the needs of the physical. The life force has to be limits itself to the frame that is provided for it by the material body. Similarly, the mind too is unable to function in its own right. It is constantly pulled down by the inertia and by the ignorance that forms the bedrock of the material body. Neither the mind nor the life force can function independently of the body as long as the dominant ruler in the life of man is the materialized soul. Even the spirit, the soul, that wants to manifest in this set of circumstances has to take account of the fragmentation of the inconscience that characterizes this order of creation. But the spirit can poise itself also in the principle of life, as it has taken its base and organized itself in matter. The spirit also organizes itself in the matrix of life force. Movement, rapidity, self-effectuation, a certain amount of freedom, these are the characteristics of life force, of the life energy. And the spirit that presides over this order of existence in the universe is the vital self, having relations with vital nature. Here also, in the individual context, the spirit becomes the vitalized soul, the pranamaya purusha. All its movements, all its perspectives are governed by the life force in which it functions. Here, it is life force that is the king. The body has to obey and respond to the pressures exerted upon it by the life force. If the body cannot sustain, the body breaks and the vital force chooses another vehicle. Similarly, even the mind, when it is connected with this vital soul, it shares certain of the fluidity that is a central feature of the vital self. Even the spirit gets more of rhythm, gets more force of self-effectuation. But if one confines oneself to the level of the vital soul, vital nature, and does not seek to go beyond, it is desire, self-aggrandizement that come to rule. Man becomes, if not a slave of desire and life energy, someone who uses life energy ignorantly. He uses it for his own aggrandizement, for the fulfillment of his own desire. He is what is called in Indian terminology the Rakshasa or the demon. A demon is a lower kind of the Titan. A Titan, an Asura, is he who can exercise any amount of self-control, do any amount of ascesis, but for his own purpose. In order to gain dominion over others, set himself up on the cosmic throne, maybe his little world. But anyway, the asuric nature, the asura thrives in this misdirected world of life energy. Similarly, there is another plane where the spirit can poise itself in its relations with nature, and that is the mental plane. Here, the divisions, the limitations of physical matter, material plane are not there, nor the turbidities, the restlessness of the vital force, neither are they there. The mental levels, the levels of the mind, where the spirit poises itself as the mental spirit or the mental self and mental nature, that is nearer the original spirit in man. That is why we say to live in the mind is to live nearer the spirit, for the mind is so constituted that under certain conditions it can reflect the will of the spirit, the vision of the spirit. Maybe it reflects only the figures and not the body. Still, it is a great step in advance. The clarities of the higher mind, the sattvic luminosities that lights up the mental functioning, these take one far ahead in the star of evolution. Even then, both the life force and the body have a great strain in following the quick steps of the mind. We are not speaking at this moment of the lower levels of the mind, the reasoning, logical, laboring, galley slave mind with which we are familiar, but the larger expanses and levels of mind touching to the borders of the spiritual planes. These open up larger vistas. Still, there are limitations. The mind cannot give us the final truths. The mind can only be an instrument for the opening of the passages to the truths. It always divides, it always fragments, it always sees in bits, in strips, and takes each strip for the whole, as Sri Aurobindo points out in Savitri. The most that the pure mind can do is to impose its harmonies, however limited they may be, impose its clarities of light and understanding on the rest of the members of the human being. Thereafter, the mind has to take a leap into the higher regions. We have spoken of the materialized soul, the life's, the vital soul, the mental soul. We have read last time from the Upanishads how to the physical Purusha, within there is another Purusha, and that is the life soul. The life soul again encloses in itself the mind soul, the mental Purusha, but that's not the end. Behind the mental self, forming the soul of the mental self, there is what is called the knowledge self. This knowledge self is the poise of the spirit on a principle of undeviating, unlimited knowledge. It is what is called vijnana in the Upanishads. What Sri Aurobindo calls the real idea, the supramental consciousness, where truth is plenarily manifest, where knowledge is self-evident, one doesn't have to labor for it, and knowledge is not separated from will, it carries in itself the power to effectuate what it sees and what it knows. This power, this self, the knowledge self, forms the knowledge sheath. And please note, this knowledge sheath which is finer than and subtler, more complete than the mental sheath, is the causal body. What is known as the causal body in Indian philosophy, it is this supramental sheath. This in turn is ensouled, I wouldn't say so much ensouled, as that in its deeper parts it turns into the bliss self. Knowledge on its summits reveals itself as bliss. And this bliss self is the foundation for the higher worlds, for the empire of the Sat Chit Anand. So the transition has to be effected from the mental to the knowledge self. That is precisely where the integral yoga comes in. All the traditional ways of yoga end with the leap of the human mind, the most developed mind, either into the transcendent silence of which the Buddha speaks. What appears as the non-existent to Shankara, in the infinite folds of the spirit. It is a matter of controversy whether the mental soul that delivers itself in those regions continues its existence in any manner or it dissolves. The mother has it that even when we say it is dissolved, in some way it maintains its individuality. That is because it is the will of the Supreme. When the Supreme emanated so many sparks out of himself, it was with a view to manifesting his glory in individual formations. When it comes back, the individual soul continues in principle, though not in form, in that stage where it is supposed to have dissolved itself. But that is not this dissolution or emergence into silence, into non-existence, into nirvana, into bliss, is not the aim of the integral seeker. He has many more worlds to traverse, many regions of consciousness and being that he has to reach, open himself to, receive them into himself, organize them in his being and manifest them. As man is constituted at present, it is only these three, the physical, the vital and the mental sheaths, that are organized and functioning. The supramental or the causal sheath, the knowledge sheath, has to be built, added as a new dimension in man. This yoga is primarily meant to achieve this formation of the supramental body in man. Otherwise it remains a matter of mental knowledge, unless it is made a constituent principle of our existence, a dynamic factor in our relations with our nature, with the world around. The knowledge sheath, the knowledge self, cannot be said to have been made operative in our life. In what way? This knowledge self is to be realized, made true, and made a dynamic factor in our life, to what extent the past traditions hold light, and what is the contribution of Sri Aurobindo and the mother to this subject will be our theme during our next talk.
You say that some souls, a few souls, merge themselves into the silence, into this nirvana. Is this a permanent state, or is there any evolution past that?
In the systems that speak of the merger of the individual soul in those levels of consciousness or bliss, that is the end of evolution. What happens is the soul declines to traverse further on the ladder of evolution that is presented to it, but withdraws and retires, so to say, in complete peace or bliss. Their contention of those philosophy is that it no more remains an individual, so there is no question of what it is going to do. It has no destiny, it has no evolution to do. Sri Aurobindo is the one thinker or seer who says that the final end of the soul is not to merge itself, to dissolve itself, but to retain its individuality and embody and manifest consciousness. Mother says, even when you say it is dissolved, still in principle the individual unit continues in the being of the Supreme. Those systems like the Buddhist or the Advaitic of Shankara don't believe in spiritual evolution. So for them the problem does not arise. They say the whole thing is a mistake. There is no, Buddhists say there is no soul to evolve. It is all a bundle of impressions, desires, satisfactions and all that. They bring a sort of a knot and we think it is the soul, it is the being. There is no being, there is no soul. By the process of dissolution of desires, withdrawal from movement, when things are dissipated, the last knot of karma automatically dissolves, and what is left is only nirvana. Shankara says that as you dispossess yourself of this world and worldly impressions, as you withdraw from your involvement in the life movement and get illumination by discrimination and study, by sadhana, the mind suddenly realizes that all this is an illusion, a fantasy, which is not real. I am not bound, I am not dead, I am always free, I am the eternal. There never was anything. If I thought there was, it is something like an imagination or a dream, a gigantic dream on the part of God. Even God is denied permanent validity in Shankara's philosophy. God, Ishvara, is a sort of president of this cosmos of ignorance. So he also gets dissolved, and only the immutable, absolute, ineffable, relationless Brahman remains. And I attain my identity with it. That is his philosophy.
How would you describe the role of the Lakshmanandir in this spiritual evolution?
Matramandir being a concrete expression of the mother's consciousness and force, it will always stand as a reservoir of inspiration. A lighthouse radiating continually. The manifestation of truth as is embodied in the mother's body. What the mother's embodiment is to us today, will be the full-fledged Matramandir to the whole of humanity. Does that make sense?
The chief architect of Aurobindo has said that it is his understanding from the mother, and this fits in exactly with what you say, that it is to be, the Matramandir is to be the receptacle, the receiving station of spiritual energy, and of the supramental consciousness, that is the truth consciousness.
What? With one, I would add, in the course of our life on earth, mother has established links with so many levels of cosmic existence. Each of these links help those parts of the cosmic being to relate themselves to the truth light. And this spiritual mechanism will also be embodied in the mandir. What I mean to say, Cyril, is that it is not only the light and the consciousness that will be radiating from there, but it will be providing the means also to realize them for each individual. The crisis has come into the open in Oroville. It is slowly gathering elsewhere. All that I can say is that everything depends upon the will of the Supreme. Mother is not exerting herself either way. She has literally surrendered herself, her body, her mind, everything to the Supreme. She refuses to make any movement on her own initiative. So this is too profound and serious a moment which our mind cannot fathom. We have to wait. I do not know whether I said here, I once asked myself, not myself, but Sri Aurobindo, in the early hours of the morning, when I was in the sea beach, as to why this prolonged agony, physical agony, for the mother. Why has she to go through? The answer is quick. She continues because there is still a possibility. I understood. That is her sacrifice. Then what is our duty? I asked. Throw your weight towards that possibility. Since then, personally, I have no problem. He perceives that there is a possibility. He expects us to put our weight on the side of that possibility. Anyway, there is nothing that we little individuals can do in this matter. matter. It is only the Supreme Will as functioning in Sri Aurobindo for this purpose that knows. The mother does not know, or she does not choose to know. Beyond this, I don't think I should say or can say anything.
In relation to this, more than a year ago, there were a set of directives given to our Mata Mandir mother, to the mother, by Shamsi, and signed with blessings by the mother. This put a special responsibility upon Mata Mandir workers because of the special nature of the Mata Mandir. Would you say that our reaction to these directives, our attitude, have any relation to the financial crisis? And the slowing up of work, blockage, really, in work and money?
I don't know about this attitude, but it is a direct result of the failure of the general consciousness to rise up to the required level. The crisis is one of consciousness and not of money. If individuals take pains and build up the type of consciousness that is expected of them, things are bound to change.
Close-knit community like this, does his own yoga, his own work upon himself?
Both, simultaneously.
Upon the community as well?
First, priority is individual yoga. And based upon that, his contribution to the collective development. If you are not enlightened yourself, there is little that you can meaningfully contribute to the general progress. So, the individual development as the basis contribution to the collectivity in result. They would say that to develop the consciousness you must first have your body. You have to live. I think living in this physical world and having to have the physical body, first thing is necessarily to keep the physical body alive. Whatever is necessary, we have to do it. But that's not the main thing. But it has to be done. Just as we devote certain part of our day for our physical needs, though we do not attach importance to it, but still they are indispensable, isn't it? Similarly, to find the ways, I mean means, to keep our body and soul together, I think it, somebody has to do it. And one can't attach too much importance to it, but it has to be done. Mother tried to see that that problem doesn't pose itself. The inmates do not have to do that. That was Mother's central idea, that it will be provided. If only you have the aspiration, if only you have the goodwill, you will be given the means wherewith you can build the city of truth. For various reasons, variety of things, things did not work out or have not worked out yet. It's not that they can't work out or they won't. The same problem as in the ashram is here, that is all. But I suppose it will be easier here to solve because of the fewer numbers than there.
And it also in meeting that problem, it's a chance to raise one's consciousness,
yes,
in the doing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It all depends ultimately upon the spirit with which we work out the program. If we do that as part of our collective yoga, to provide means for everyone around us to live a healthy life in order to participate in the experiment or project, it does become something more than an administrative measure. The question boils down to this. Each individual has to look into himself and see what has been his contribution, positively and negatively. That will be a more rewarding process. Have I, by my thought, words or action, contributed to a general disharmony at any time? Have I made any sacrifice for the collective good? Have I given up my self-centeredness? These are the lines on which the pursuit of self-inquiry has to proceed. Mm-hmm.